Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Words and Sound. I'm Chris Stagg, and my very special guest today is horror writer Adrian Rowe. Adrian and I talk all about his Scream trilogy, which looks at horror films of the 70s, 80s and 90s. We also talk about his brand new book, Bled Dry, which focuses on the vampire subgenre. Adrian takes on the Words and Sound quiz with his specialist subject, 80s horror, and we also have a competition in this episode, so listen very carefully, and I'll explain more about that at the end of the show. All music on today's episode has been chosen by Adrian, and all that and more is coming up right after this.
I never thought I would be at 23 on the verge of spontaneous combustion. Woe is me, but I guess that it comes with a territory, an ominous landscape of never-ending calamity. I need you to hear, I need you to see, but I have had, I can take an exploding scene, bigger than it's possibility. Earth, like gravity, hypocrisy, and the perils of being in free. But thinking so much takes time.
Okay, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
And we're talking all things horror. So tell me to start with, where did your fascination with horror films come from?
Yeah, I mean, as far back as I can remember, I think is the honest answer. I mean, even as a child, I just remember being drawn and fascinated to sort of video covers in the rental shops and covers of Fangoria and all the rest of it, just sort of really pulled in and attracted to the fantastic and the sort of forbidden element, if you like, of horror films, certainly as a child. So always being fascinated with it and wanting to watch it as early as I could. I mean, even sort of, you know, gateway stuff like Ghostbusters and Poltergeist. As a child, I'd sit there in my mouth wide open and just, you know, wouldn't move through the entirety of it. So I think the whole sort of dark element and the whole sort of fantasy and escapism really, really pulled me in early on. Absolutely.
You know, that really echoes my own experience as well. Bizarrely, that you should say that completely randomly, that I can remember very, very much, you know, when you go to the old VHS video shops, I can remember going with my dad and he'd want to go and get a kung fu film or something. And I used to sneak to the horror aisle and I just used to be fascinated by the covers and I'd sort of dare myself to pick one up and look at the back.
Yeah, absolutely. Just trying to get a glimpse of those images that you were perhaps not supposed to, or the feeling that you weren't supposed to.
Because, you know, there was one that really stuck in my mind. Well, there was two that really stuck in my mind, the old VHS covers. One was Critters, and the other one, and it took me a long, long time to find out what it was, but it was the cover of Fright Night.
Yes, absolutely. Do you know what? I think that probably goes down as one of the best pieces of cover art in our history. I recently sort of made a point of saying that. Absolutely fantastic. And I loved it when Part 2 came out, and certainly in the UK, they used the same backdrop, the same image, but obviously against the sort of the tower block or the apartment block that Peter Vincent was then living in. They used it side by side, which was fantastic. As a child, you're mesmerised by that. And I remember also reading novels when I was young, obviously Bram Stoker's Dracula. I read a lot of sort of James Herbert stuff, The Rats and the Fog, and just as early as I remember, just being really intrigued by the sort of the darker side of literature, and then obviously film as I got older. Yeah.
Do you know, I think I've only ever read one James Herbert book, and I think it was one called The Ghosts of Slaith.
Okay, yeah.
And I can remember it was like the reason my dad got it for me. I think he got it for me for my 13th birthday, because the cover of it was like a really... it was like a fake old book cover. Yeah. And when I read this thing, it was really X-rated. Yeah. it was constantly full of sex. There was more sex than ghosts, I think.
Yeah, on pretty thick. I remember in The Rats, that was quite similar as well. But going back to covers, it's funny, isn't it? But as a child, I remember judging a book. They say, don't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, we all do.
And looking at those James Herbert novels as a child, I remember it exactly the same. So I think the visual impact of horror, I think, is what I'm trying to say, as a child, definitely draws you in, certainly drew me in.
Do you remember the first horror film you ever saw?
Oh, my word. Probably not specifically the same film. However, I do remember that one of my first introductions to horror would have been the glorious Hammer horror stuff. You know, I mean, I still do adore those films, absolutely adore them, and maybe partly because that was an introduction for me when I was young. I remember sort of, I had to sneak a TV into my room when I was very young. I wasn't allowed a television in my room, so I managed to sneak one in, and I remember just staying up late at night, and obviously before Sky TV and before cable and all the rest of it. I don't know if you remember, Chris, but they would run these old films through the night on ITV, and I remember just staying up as late as I could, trying to watch as many as I could. And I caught up on many of the Hammer horror stuff. So those films certainly served as a gateway for me into horror. And then, as I said earlier, a lot of the more sort of PG stuff, Ghostbusters and even Jaws and films like that, I remember as being my earliest introduction to the genre. And just hooked, just attached from those early days and sort of went on from there. But I would say Hammer horror. The Hammer horror films would be my first, but I can't remember a specific individual film, unfortunately.
I can remember, I think mine was very similar, but mine, I think, would have been Amicus. And I just, again, before I knew what they were, I can remember my dad showing me these. Whenever my mum would go out, he would show me the next day during the day these Amicus portmanteau horrors.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure if this is related, but my parents got divorced when I was 9. So I would have been very young when he showed them to me. I'm not sure what kind of parenting that was. But it certainly sparked my fascination with it.
Yeah, no, glorious anthologies, Amicus. Yeah, Vault of Horror, I think.
I can remember as well, when you talk about sneaking videos into your room or staying up late in your room, I can remember the first horror film I stayed up late to watch. I was well into my teens. I was probably about 15. But it was, do you remember Sci-Fi used to do Sci-Fright on a Friday night?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And I can remember watching this, absolutely terrified me, was The Evil Dead 2.
I'm not surprised. How old are you, 13?
Really,
Yeah.
It really that scene where you know when they're in the when he's in the cabin, the scene where the deer on the wall, the head sort of cracks and starts laughing. Yeah. Of all the things, that was the one. Or no, wait, Henrietta in the fruit cellar.
Yeah. I mean, that's ferocious stuff. Even by today's standards, you put on those Raimi films, and they still hit a nerve. Absolutely, they still deliver the goods even today.
Have you ever watched the Evil Dead series?
I haven't, actually. I haven't. You know what? I'm not a huge... I get sort of criticised for it all the time. I don't spend as much time watching TV as I should. I'm obsessed with films, as you know. But no, I've not actually seen a TV series. That is something I need to get around to doing. Absolutely.
It's actually really good. I shied away from it a while because I loved the film so much. I thought, well, I don't really want to taint them. Yes. But it's literally just like Evil Dead 2. It's just the right amount of gore, Sam Raimi gore, and comedy as well. And it's fantastic. You've really got to check that out.
I will do. And talking of Evil Dead, did you like the remake? The remake that was done a while ago?
I did. I really did like it. I thought it was brutal.
Yeah, it was. It was a good bit of horror. I think they did a fantastic job. It's always difficult remaking those classics, and that's a conversation for another day.
Well, I had a conversation with someone who said to me, yeah, I liked it, but it wasn't as funny as the original. And I said, yeah, but the original wasn't funny. You're thinking of Evil Dead 2. The original Evil Dead, even though it's an incredibly similar storyline, I'm still not clear on whether Evil Dead 2 is a remake, but the original Evil Dead wasn't funny at all and was quite graphic.
At all. And it's criminally overlooked, the original. A lot of people, and you just highlighted it there, they'll remember Evil Dead 2 because it was obviously a few years had passed and it was done on a bigger budget and it was sort of more visually entertaining maybe and more humorous. And people remember that film. People don't always remember the original, which I think is a great shame.
So let's talk about your books now. You've got a series of three Scream series focusing on horror from the 70s, 80s and 90s. How did that come about? Where did you start with that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, where are we now? It was 2012, 2013. I started writing the first book. I'd always been, you know, my passion has always been horror movies. Some would say obsession, maybe. And around that time, I just felt, I don't know, creative urge. I wanted to do something with it. And so writing a book on some of my favourite films just sprung to mind. I was actually in the library and I was reading another book that was completely unrelated to the genre, and it was one of these generic books after the films you must see or something like that, and you can do this book. I was thinking, do you know what, it'd be great to see a book like this just with my favorite films in it, just with horror. And then I thought, well, let's do it, why not, let's do it. And that's where the idea came from. And I literally spent the next couple of years just putting this book together, bit at a time, which became effectively a list of my favorite films from the 80s. I chose the 80s initially because that had always been probably my favorite decade from the genre. Certainly the decade I grew up in.
Do you consider that your decade when it really came into its own for you?
Only because, yes, that's the decade I grew up in, and that's the decade that I discovered the genre. So I consider that to be the decade I was not only most knowledgeable about at the time, but obviously most passionate about. Every weekend I'd sit down and still do and watch those you know, nasties from yesteryear. And I felt that was the natural decade to put a book together about art, which I did. So the first book probably took me, it was about 2 years to put together. But I wanted it to be more than just a list of films. I wanted to bring something more to this book and give it a bit of colour. And I made the decision to try and reach out and get people involved, artists involved, or people who have worked within the genre, directors, actors, producers, get them involved as well. Didn't have a clue what I was doing, Chris, I'm totally honest with you. As we do, this whole thing was just literally fueled from passion. I hadn't done any of this sort of work before. I'd never written for anybody else. I'd never written for a website, a magazine, a blog, nothing. This was just something I decided to take on myself and just have a go at. And I was absolutely overwhelmed with the response that I received. I reached out to many people and to my surprise, they were sort of bowled over and delighted to be involved. And that helped the project at the time, no end, obviously, with my lack of sort of connections at that point. Mm. And so the book became a list of films. It became a fantastic collection of interviews and essays from many artists, which I continue to speak to this day. So it was a very passionate project on my part. And that's how the first book came about. La 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 la.
when you was working on the first book, did you have in mind then that it would be the first of several, or was it just a standalone at that point?
Yeah, not at all. As I say, it was more, it really started off like a lot of these things do, as a bit of a hobby, really. I wasn't really thinking about the end product when I was doing it. I was enjoying it. It was purely fueled by passion. Never really thought beyond writing it, to be honest with you, at that stage. When a lot of names became involved, people like Wes Craven and Tom Holland and many others, yeah, I started getting a bit excited because I thought, blimey, okay, this is turning into quite a nice book. But even then, I didn't think I'd go on and do others. This was always going to be a one-off for me, just writing about, you know, my favourite decade. So certainly at the time of writing it, no, there was no intention to go further.
So we've got to pick this up now. How on earth did you get Wes Craven?
Honest answer, Chris, I haven't got a clue.
Was it just blind?
I don't know, mate. People ask me all the time, and not just about Wes, but many of the fantastic names I've been very fortunate enough to work with. The thing just seemed to sort of snowball, really. I mean, Tom Holland was one of the first people that I reached out to, and he was kind enough to do an interview with me regarding Fright Night and Child's Play. Tom Holland then actually introduced me to Wes Craven. That's how Wes got involved, and Tom also introduced me to Mick Garris, and it works like that. You just seem to, you know, get on with people.
That's really nice, isn't it? Because he must have really respected how you'd approach things with him and what you'd done with him for him. Otherwise, he wouldn't have put you forward for other people.
Absolutely. I think if you're just honest about what you're doing and why you're doing it, it goes a long way. It's not as if you have, I don't know, a paid journalist looking to do a piece together and get paid for that gig and use people for that piece. This was very much cards on the table from the start. This is my project, my book. You know, I'm not profiteering from this. This is something I'm doing for love, for passion. Would you like to be a part of that? And I think that goes a long way. And I think a lot of the people that came on board at that time, certainly from what the feedback I was getting from these individuals was very much that they enjoyed being a part of that passion and a part of that project. And then I think if you can, you're quite right, Chris, I think anything we do in life, I think if you're networking and treating people as you wish to be treated, and they can see that it's going to good cause for the right reasons, they want to be a part of it. And that seemed to happen with the first book. It seemed to ignite, this project that kept moving forward and more names came on board, which was brilliant. So yes, Wes Craven, and asked your question, was Tom Holland kindly introduced me and I worked with Wes on that book, and then a few other bits and bobs afterwards as well, and it was it meant a great deal to me. Obviously, get somebody involved and the other.
I suppose as well, it's quite interesting you say about you know, not being a journalist and this being something of a passion for you. I suppose from their position, they must get all the time big publications and things, especially if they've got something new coming out. They want an interview with them, and it's probably the same mundane questions from someone who may or may not likely not know their work. And then on the flip side, they've got someone doing something off their own back who's very passionate about a subject, a genuine fan of their work. And when you look at it like that, it's a no-brainer, really, isn't it? I mean, you could argue, if they're a decent person, why wouldn't they? So I think that's really good. And when it goes on to others as well, I suppose once you had the first one done, it gives a little bit of traditional credibility to being introduced to more people after that.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to your first question, that was the only reason the books continued. I never expected I never expected the first to sort of, you know, become the book it did become, and certainly not have the reaction it did. And because of that, yes, that very much acts as a self-generated platform, if you like. You sort of can feed off of that energy, and people are enjoying it and embracing what you've done. That's obviously the most rewarding aspect above all. And have that is a gift, because that then enables you to move forward and create something new. And yes, the first came to the last. It sort of naturally evolved, really. It was an organic growth. It was something that I didn't plan. It just sort of happened through, yes, the kindness of some very special people getting involved, and then moving forward, horror fans embracing it to a degree that was enough to warrant moving forward, and which ended up in obviously three books in total. And again, it does see that the platform grows, I think, or it certainly did for me with every book, and that enabled me to reach out to others and network further. and create a whole trilogy is now what we've ended up with, rather than just one book, which was extremely satisfying and rewarding. And yeah, just continue to be grateful to everybody that's got involved.
You must look at them on the shelf next to each other and just think, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I have them in the cabinet with a few other bits of horror paraphernalia. And you do, you sort of...
The odd skull and...
Absolutely, yeah, we'll go into detail about that, Chris. But yeah, there's you do look at them, and I look back and the dozens and dozens of artists which were kind enough to be involved and contribute. I still have to pinch myself and ask the question you asked me earlier, is how the hell did I pull that off? But I did, and yes, I'm very, very proud of them, but extremely grateful for the people that have picked them up.
So the 90s one being called The Last Scream, does that mean there's not going to be any more entries?
Well, it's funny the way they panned out, because I often get asked that question, why did I sort of do them back to front? So I did the 80s, and then, yeah, Second Scream was the 90s, and that was the natural sequel to do, if you like, about a year or so after First Scream to the Last. The response, as you know, was pretty positive, and I thought, well, it's an actual progression.
Oh, so the 70s is the final Scream?
The 70s was the last, so... because I did the 90s and you know, the 90s is, it's a funny decade. I sort of pitched it as the decade that horror forgot when writing the book, because, you know, for me, and this is all subjective, we all think things differently. I do view the 90s as possibly the weakest era, one of, for the horror genre, although there were some outstanding films within that time.
I can probably count on one hand the films that I really love from that.
Give me a few. What's some of your favourites?
From the 90s, I would say... you stop me if these are not 90s now, but the original Scream.
Yep.
And I think Jeepers Creepers.
Yeah.
The Faculty, or are we going into the 2000s now?
Yeah, that was 98. Candyman.
Yeah, there's a few that are really, really good.
Oh, and there was some great direct-to-video stuff like Dr. Giggles and you know, Return of the Living Dead 3, and there's a lot of stuff there that came out that is often overlooked these days, and we all sort of go back to the 80s, and the 90s is a decade that's definitely worth revisiting more than we'd like to remember, I think. And so that was the reason I put Second Screen together, and that was a similar project to the First Screen book. And again, some brilliant names came on board. We had a Langham Campbell Dream Nightmare, Wes pitched in again on People Under the Stairs, Judy Carman, In the Mouth of Madness, John Carpenter's film, another great 90s.
So, oh, In the Mouth of Madness is fantastic.
Second Scream continued, and then when that one came out, a similar response, and I like trilogies. So I thought at that point I need to wrap this up and do a third book, and I went back to probably the most important decade of them all, finishing off with the trilogy with the final Scream, which was the 70s, which, very important decade. I enjoyed that book.
So does that mean... You would consider doing some more?
Do you know what? I never say never, because after every book, I sort of never really planned it immediately, and it seems to happen. So I certainly would never say never. There's no immediate plans for me to pick up on that series. It sits well where it is. And obviously, I have to remember that the only reason these books exist really is from passion. And the 70s, 80s, and 90s really remain my most sort of passionate decades, really, within the genre. So... it could happen, but I think I would have to sort of think of something which, again, you know, sparks that passion and enable me to, you know, would pay credit to those decades. So nothing immediately planned, but yeah, as I say never.
Give me some of your favourite horror films from those decades.
Blimey. I think, let's start from the beginning then. So the 70s, as I said earlier, one of the reasons I had to finish with the 70s is I do view it probably as the most important decade within the genre. I think the films created within the 70s really sort of laid down the blueprint of what was to come and influence things we're still doing today. They really sort of set down the perimeters for the subgenres that we all love and know to this day. So exploitation cinema, for example, one of my favorite films of all time is Toby Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Ghost stories, haunted house stories, The Changeling, for example.
That's massively underrated, I think.
Underrated. It sort of got overshadowed a bit by The Shining.
Yeah.
Came out roughly the same time, but The Changeling is a massive film. If you haven't seen that, go check it out. If you like your haunted house stuff, it's...
It's brilliant. It's really creepy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the zombie subgenre. I mean, you know, George A. Romero obviously delivered Night of the Living Dead in the 60s, but it was the 70s that really took it up to another level with Dawn of the Dead. Italian stuff, love the Italian stuff. Suspiria, that was one from the 70s. That's one of my favourites. You could argue that although it wasn't the first slasher film, certainly mainstream, John Carpenter gave birth to Halloween in the 70s.
Brilliant.
So the 70s really was, I think, pivotal. You know, there's an old argument, isn't there, quality versus quantity. And I think although the 80s gave us the floodgates opened in the 80s, if you like, and it was the video age and everything became accessible, and we'll remember the 80s for those reasons.
There's a lot of filtering has to happen in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the 70s really, when you're looking at the quality within the genre, and of course, the Hammer Horror stuff was still going, although it was of their existence, there was some great stuff in the 70s from them. I love the Karnstein trilogy from Hammer. I love Vampire Circus. There's some good stuff in the 70s from Hammer. And then 80s, do you know what, Chris? I pretty much loved everything from the 80s. I think it would have been poor for me not to sit down and watch it. The 80s was a fantastic time for the slasher film, clearly. The slasher film, Wes Craven came along with Elm Street, and there's just so many classics. I think we'll be here all day if we've listed them. But the 80s was just, everybody was at it, you could do it. You know, it was like punk rock in the 70s. Anyone could pick up a guitar and get on with it. Horror in the 80s was like that. You know, filmmakers were just lining up. Anything was being produced to a certain degree and made. And so it opened up, you know, it introduced many of us to horror, I think, just because of the sheer amount of content and the accessibility of it all in the 80s.
And what about you for the 90s?
90s, I criticised it. Well, I didn't criticise it, but I do think it was poor in retrospect when looking at those other two decades. But the 90s, you know, mid-90s, we did see a new wave of slasher films, which Wes kicked off with Scream, obviously. Urban Legend, and I did last summer, films like Cherry Falls, I know that was 2000, but there was this great resurgence of films that were smart.
Cherry Falls, I feel, was another one that was kind of missed. What about Ginger Snaps as well? Was that 90s?
It was around that time, was it? Late 90s? But things had become very smart by then. These films were self-reflective of themselves. They were satirical almost, you know? So
I always feel like the slasher films after Scream never really lived up to Scream.
No, I mean, that was a parody and it was an effective film, but then you're talking Wes Craven, so it's, you know, it's very difficult to live up to something he's created, maybe.
And yeah.
I do enjoy the others that came along, but Scream, not loved by all. It has its detractors. Not everybody is a Scream fan. I personally do love it. The man was a genius. I think he created something which really did, you know, kickstart.
I think like anything, the franchise lost its way a bit and got diluted, but that first film, the impact of the first film, you know, especially the Hello Sydney, and you know, the whole beginning of it is fantastic.
Well, Wes Craven did what he did for two decades prior to that. He effectively reinvented the genre. The man was a genius, you know, creative genius. He would come along every decade. He did it in the 70s with Last House on the Left, Hills Have Eyes, in the 80s with Freddie and Elm Street, and then he did it again in the 90s. He effectively reinvented the genre three times when he did it with Scream. That is a unique man with a unique talent, and that's a credit to him.
And your new book now, Bled Dry, out now?
Yes, absolutely. It was released a couple of weeks ago. Bled Dry deals with the history of vampires in film. So over 100 years now, the vampires sort of plagued our nightmares on film, and it's a subgenre I'm very passionate about. And as I said earlier, my work really is fueled by that passion, nothing else. So I had to come up with something which was going to enable me to find that ambition and spark something else together. And the vampire subgenre fitted quite nicely, and it was a book I was very excited about. I thoroughly enjoyed writing it, and I'm really proud of it now it's here.
I mean, what I've noticed about the book as well is not just looking at vampire and film, there's the whole folklore behind it. There's a nice introduction passage to it as well. So it's not just, if you just look at the cover, you might think, oh, it's a list of vampire films. It's not at all. It's a really good companion piece. Especially it's a kind of where to go next if you're taking your first step in this as a genre as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad you picked up on that. It was, I wanted to put something together that was similar to the Scream books. They've obviously been popular. I didn't want it to become a piece of heavy academic work. There are people out there far smarter than me, so I'll just leave them to that. I wanted this to be fun. I wanted it to be a little bit more have a bit more depth maybe than the screen books which it has, that you've noticed. But above all, there was so much to cover because the vampire subgenre is unique. It's the oldest subgenre within horror. The mythology and the folklore to it are unlike nothing else. So there's more history, it's steeped in history, and there's a lot more depth there than any other subgenre. So it was something that was certainly worth writing about and something that I was desperate to put together, and I'm glad I have. But yeah, again, I managed to pull in certain key filmmakers and artists to sort of give it some colour. I'm very proud of that. Tom Holland, bless him, has written the foreword, which is fantastic. Creator of Fright Night, which I think is probably one of the best contemporary films, if we can still call it that, of course. It was the 80s. Genius piece of work. Fright Night is, you know, you speak to people about their favourite vampire films, and that one comes up again and again and again. So, yeah, so that's where we... And it was just fascinating putting it together because the evolution of the subgenre is just staggering. You know, I mean, you're looking at the first sort of film that featured vampires, you know, looking back, which was a three-minute short in 1896, and then you move right forward to today, and the evolution and development of the subgenre has really been like absolutely nothing else, really.
Is that right? The first vampire film was in 1896? Yeah,
the first vampire film. There's rumours, and there's lost films, and there's films that purported to exist that have never been found. But the first documented vampire film, House of the Devil, was a three-minute short. And it's actually regarded as the first ever horror film as well. So vampires really introduced the world to horror, you could say.
And that was 1896, you say?
Yeah, 1896.
Wow.
So when I started researching and looking into a lot of this, it just, you know, pulled together, you know, all of what I'd already sort of learned and my suspicions about the vampire subgenre, that it certainly was worthy of putting together and sort of illustrating to people who maybe like their horror, they like the vampire films and want to know a bit more. I wanted to give them that piece. And as you rightly said, there's some interesting work in there on the mythology and history, as much as a sort of a timeline of vampire films that the book delivers.
Because I was thinking, well, one of the earliest that I could think of would have been Universal's original Dracula. Mm. But and I'm thinking, it was Nosferatu after that?
So no, Nosferatu was before that. That was one of the first, well, it was the first adaptation of Stoker's Dracula, although it was unlicensed. Did you know about the legal case that followed that film, Chris?
No, I mean, I was aware that they changed him to Count Orlok because they couldn't use Dracula.
Yeah. Well, they. So 1922, Nosferatu, and obviously what he basically did was he wrote his own, Murano this is, he wrote his own adaptation, didn't obtain the necessary rights for Stoker's novel because he thought, you know, I'll change Dracula's name and I'll change this here and change that there, it'd be enough to get away with it. But he didn't. He was obviously sued by the Stoker estate, and effectively that the film was withdrawn, banned, and orders were given for all copies to be destroyed. Thankfully, a copy survived, and that is where we are today. We've all sort of watched it and regard it as one of the best sort of pieces ever made. And
yes.
That was the 1920s. So that was before the Universal Pictures that you alluded to, and obviously before the Hammer stuff. So yes, that was the first sort of adaptation.
Ah, that's why I thought it came out after, because I thought the conflict was with Universal, not the Stoker Estate.
No, it was actually with the Stoker Estate. Yeah. And then, of course, the remake that they did it again in the 70s, German film in 79. Which again is a fantastic, fantastic movie. I don't know if you've seen that, but a remake was made in 1979, which is an absolutely stunning piece of filmmaking.
A remake of Nosferatu.
Remake of Nosferatu.
No, I haven't seen that. No.
Werner Herzog in 1979 remade it, and the guy who played Nosferatu, his name escapes me, Paul Skinski. That's right. He played Nosferatu, and he's called Count Dracula in this adaptation because they have the legal right to do so, unlike the original. But it's a fantastic, beautiful piece of filmmaking. It really is. Gorgeous cinematography. Fantastic.
Because if I remember rightly, I could be really, really remembering incorrectly here, but if you read Bram Stoker's Dracula, doesn't Count Orlok more closely resemble Dracula than the kind of suave Bela Lugosi Dracula? I seem to remember him having two pointy teeth very close together in the novel.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, that again is the beauty of the vampire subgenre. It's so fluid, and you know, so much can be done with it. And we all have our different sort of generations come along and tell the tale they want it to, or give us the vision they want us to see. But everything can be adapted, and you're quite right. Dracula is a great example, really, when you see how that creature has evolved and how he's been presented to us, sometimes popular, sometimes not so popular, but the evolution of that one character is incredible. Mm. And I know the BBC did their own series last year, which was fantastic in the sense that it gave us yet another, you know, unique spin on the character himself. So he's a fascinating villain, and obviously throughout sort of horror history, he's served faithfully and has been reincarnated in many different ways. And you're quite right, it's quite fascinating. And you like Christopher Lee, obviously.
I had real mixed feelings on that adaptation. I liked what they was trying to do. I didn't feel like it always hit the mark. Funnily enough, I liked the second episode the best, and I was reading online. I think a lot of people felt that was the weakest, was the second episode, and it was the one on the boat, was the one that I really enjoyed the most.
It was, I had mixed feelings about it when watching it, but I, in retrospect, look back, and full respect for making it the original piece of work that they did, and they did something very different with the character. And I mean, how many times has Dracula been retold? You can't really find a piece of
work. If you're going to just do it the same, then don't bother. You know, you've got to go for something new, and you'll either fail or not, but at least you've tried.
I respect anybody that does that. And there's a lot about that new Dracula that I didn't personally enjoy, but at the same time, you have to look at what people have done and respect for that reason, really. Absolutely.
I'm not saying it's your fault, although you could have done more. Oh, you're so naive, yes, so how could this be done with such a smiling sweetheart? Oh, and your sweet and pretty face is such an ugly way for something so beautiful. Oh, that every time I look inside, I know she knows that I'm not fond of asking. True or false it may be, or she's still out to get me. And I know, she knows, that I'm not fond of asking. True or false it may be, she's still out to get me. I may say it was your fault, because I know you could have done more. You're so I'm pretty face, it's a gin ugly world. Something so
So putting you on the spot now, your top five, not necessarily in any order, your top five vampire films and why?
Word. Can I give you 50? That might be easier. I'll give you five. Let me think of five that I really adore. I mean, obviously, there is no order and there are many other honourable mentions I could add to it that would be here all day. But if I'm thinking of five films I love, Salem's Lot, Toby Hooper's Salem's Lot from 79. Absolutely fantastic piece of filmmaking. Obviously based on a great novel by King, but it's such a haunting and atmospheric movie. Never fails to impress me, and I regard it as one of the last true gothic masterpieces that have been made, and hopefully we'll have a revival shortly with the remake. But Salem's Lot is right up there. Obviously, Fright Night, that was where your question was going. So yeah, your Fright Night. Tom Fright Night has to be right up there, because Tom achieved something very difficult, very difficult. He managed to sort of drag the classic vampire story into what was then contemporary times, and he did it so successfully, because Jerry Dandridge did evoke the spirit of the classic sort of vampire tale, if you like, Night. But what Tom did was manage to pull that into today's, or what was then today's world, and did it seamlessly. He really did, because it evoked that spirit and that atmosphere and that tone of the classic sort of vampire movies I love, and just encompassed it within the fun of the 80s. And it's a magical piece of filmmaking. There's so much charm to that film. And obviously with the actors and everything involved.
See, so far you've gone for two of my favourites as well.
Oh, I'm doing well. Three more to go. I can't not mention Christopher Lee. To be honest, mate, I love anything Christopher Lee is in. I think most of us do. Any of his Dracula films I love, even the later ones that some people sort of turn their nose up. I thoroughly enjoy them. But the Terence Fisher adaptation from 58, I think that's one of the best adaptations that we've seen, personally.
Me too. We're three each.
We're three each. I adore it. But I love all of Christopher Lee's, you know, films. I don't know, a couple of my favourites.
Even Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
I might draw the line there, mate. Might draw the line. So classic Hammer stuff. Trying to think. So something else from the 80s, maybe. Near Dark, Catherine Bigelow, what a talented woman. So Near Dark was, again, a very clever film. Vampire definitely went through a resurgence through the 80s. It became very fashionable again to make vampire films. And Near Dark was one of the reasons why. Catherine Bigelow gave us a visually stunning and interesting variant on the vampire love story, really. And it was a bit of a Western, and there were some classic actors involved, and just very innovative, original film. So Near Dark is up there. And I'll throw in a curveball. Jean Rollin, the French director, he probably delivered more vampire films than anybody else, certainly through the 70s. And one of my favourites, he's very much an auteur. You either like his work, Rollin, or you don't. I'm fascinated by it. And probably one of my favourite films of his is The Living Dead Girl. That is the cover of my book, in case anybody was wondering. Because what Jean Rollin managed to do was to deliver a vampire film that wasn't a vampire film in some respects. There are no traits there that you normally see. There are no fangs, there are no crosses. It's a shocking, violent, and quite emotional tale, really, about the pains of being a vampire and some of the human pains that come with it. And I won't give anything away in case anybody hasn't seen it and they want to see something a bit different. Go and check out Jean Rollin's A Living Dead Girl. I thoroughly rate that film. Honorable mentions. I love Vamp. I got to interview Dee Dee Pfeiffer for the new book.
Yes.
For Vamp. Absolutely adore Vamp. Vamp to me is criminally underrated. It came along at a very tough time. It was sandwiched in between The Lost Boys and Fright Night. Vampire, I love probably just as much as the others. It's extremely smart film, lovely lighting, well directed, great cast, funny film. So I'll give Vamp an oral version as well. So many others, really. So many others.
I think for my top five, same first three as yours. I'd have to have The Lost Boys in there.
Yeah.
And maybe a controversial one, I'd go for Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula as well.
I like controversy. Do you know what? When that film first came out in the 90s, I went to see it at the cinema and I couldn't stand it. I really didn't like it.
Really? Was it Keanu Reeves' accent?
I don't know what it was. Maybe, I think when you're younger, you're more sort of, I don't know, you're not as open-minded as much, are you? As you
get older.
And now I love it. Now I do actually love it. Now
I kind of first liked it because it's got my all-time favourite musician, Tom Waits, in it.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's what first drew me to it.
Yeah, yeah. It blows me away now. But as I say, when I was younger, I wasn't really a fan. I think when you're young, you're a bit arrogant, aren't you? You think you know everything. I thought, I know my Dracula. That's not Christopher Lee. Or that's not Bela Lugosi.
Yeah. No, you're right.
A bit of ignorance on my part. But now I look back and I think, no, what a fantastic film. Certainly visually, there's a lot going on there.
I think my honourable mentions, I'd have to have Blade, possibly even Blade 2 over Blade.
Yeah.
Not Blade 3, though, because that was just awful.
Yeah.
And I quite like 30 Days of Night.
Yes. Yeah.
And one I only saw for the first time recently, believe it or not. I think, what's the one with James Woods in as the vampire hunter?
Vampires, John Carpenter's
Vampire. I only saw it for the first time a few weeks ago, and I thought it was great.
You're making me feel guilty. All these names I should have given you in my top five, but there's too many. No, absolutely. I mean, there's other stuff. There's other stuff, you know, Let the Right One In. I mean, and the remake was good as well.
Both of them.
Brilliant films.
Isn't there a Del Toro one as well?
Cronus,
yeah, that's it, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
that's a strange one.
It is, but this again is the very essence of why I wanted to write about vampires, because it's like anything else, there's so much there. You could talk about it all day, because the variance and the different style of filmmaking within the subgenre is quite fascinating.
So you're going to have to write a sequel now.
You could. I mean, you could write a series of books on vampires. That was the only thing that crossed my mind, because you could literally hone in on different aspects and you could keep going forever. You really could. I mean, you look at where it's evolved. I mean, I think that the last vampire film I watched was Bliss, called that a Fright Fest, the sort of world premiere at Fright Fest last year, Joe, because it's Bliss. I mean, that's a crazy film. And just you look at films like that and how far the vampire subgenre has come, it really is quite fascinating.
It's time in the show now. It's my favourite bit. It's the quiz.
Oh, no.
I'm expecting good things from you, Adrian. Your specialist subject, 80s horror. No pressure, obviously. No
pressure at all. Blimey, where's this going to lead me? Okay, all right.
I mean, people historically don't do very well in this quiz.
Start. I like that.
For whatever reason, the pressure gets to them. And people don't do well. However, the maximum I normally get through is about 16 questions tops in 2 minutes. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Sarah Jouffert, the ballet dancer. Okay. She got 14 and a half out of 16.
You have given me pressure, Chris. You can't do that to me.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
How many... Oh, hang on, I'm pressed start. It's going well already. You almost got a couple of extra seconds. Right, here we go. How many films in the Friday the 13th franchise were released in the 1980s?
Oh, I'm going to go for 8.
Correct. Oh. Which film's violence sparked changes to the Motion Picture Association of America's rating system? Was it Poltergeist, The Beyond, or Gremlins?
Poltergeist.
Gremlins. Who starred in 1980's The Shining? Tom Selleck, Jack Nicholson, Harrison Ford?
Jack Nicholson.
Correct. What role did famed director Steven Spielberg have in the creation of Poltergeist?
He was... he didn't direct it, although a lot of people would disagree with me, but he produced it.
And correct. Drew Barrymore made her feature film debut in which 80s horror flick? Altered States, Sleepaway Camp, Silver Bullet?
Silver Bullet.
Altered States.
No, yes, what am I thinking?
Which horror film did Sam Raimi write and direct? The Evil Dead, The Fly, Creepshow?
Evil Dead.
Correct. How many Puppet Master movies followed the original, which was released in 1989?
Oh, my word. There'd be so many.
5, 3, or 9?
It's got to be 9. Got to be 9.
Correct.
Yeah.
In Gremlins, what substance caused the adorable Mogwais to turn into terrifying, angry monsters?
It's if they eat after midnight.
Correct. How does a devastated father bring his son back to life in Pet Sematary?
Buries him in the Pet Sematary.
Correct. How many A Nightmare on Elm Street films were released in the 80s?
In the 80s?
3, 6, or 5?
There was 5.
Correct. Which city is the focal point of City of the Living Dead? Is it Los Angeles, Sacramento, New York?
Um, 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 Oh God, I'm going to go for New York.
Correct. And we're up out of time, but I've started. So Halloween 2 was released in 1981. How many years after the first Halloween film was it made?
3 years.
Correct.
I'm looking, Chris. I wasn't totting up. Oh, you were.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
10? And how does that rank on average with your other...
Well, you're an easy second.
Oh, an easy second. Story of my life. Yeah, no, that's
it. Story of my life, Chris.
Absolutely, I'll take that.
I think most people normally get, believe it or not, most people normally get about 6. So you did really, really well.
I appreciate it. And thanks for the easy questions. I appreciate it. There were a few chucked in there. I needed those.
So tell us what's next for you. I mean, obviously, Bled Dry's just come out, but have you got any plans for any more books coming up?
I would be shocked if there aren't any. I have nothing written in stone at this stage. I'm going to, Bled Dry took quite a while. It led me dry, took quite a bit of my time. So I'm going to enjoy the next sort of 6 months or so promoting that and seeing how that goes and where that takes me. I've already written a couple of screenplays. That's something I might look at getting back into.
Excellent.
Yeah, you know, it'd be great to sort of put a film together. It's great to love films. It'd be even better to write one.
A horror film, I'm assuming.
Absolutely, yeah. I do have a few ideas, and I've already written a couple of screenplays. And, yeah, I've had some positive reactions from a few producers I know. I think there's things I can do to improve my writing with regard to that. So if I can maybe put another screenplay together, we'll see what happens. That's
really fantastic.
And yes, I mean, we'll see what happens with Bled Dry, and I wouldn't be surprised if you see more books from me in the future. It's been too much fun not to do it again. I've enjoyed it. I seem to have created a niche there for myself, which works and sort of enables me to sort of almost become a part of the genre that I love. And so I think I'd be silly not to continue that. I think as long as people are enjoying them, I'll continue to write them. I think that's the thing. I think it's just very grateful that people will pick them up and take the time to read them, really.
And where's the best place for people to find your books?
I would probably, certainly what's going on at the moment, because there's a lot of bookstores and distributors and vendors are delaying non-essential items, and quite rightly so. So I'd probably say Amazon at the moment. If you pop the title into Amazon, you'll find it. I know, or I've been told, they've got stock of the hardback and the paperback, and you can also read it via Kindle if you prefer to that as well. So probably Amazon would be the best bet at the moment. Yeah.
And could you give us your social media links and any websites or anything that you have so people can follow you? Follow you on social media, not in real life. That's something entirely different.
That's a bit weird, yeah. I'm on Twitter. My tag is @firstscreen2. So if you plug that in, or just plug Adrian Rowan, you'll find me on Twitter. I'm not a huge fan of social media. I don't use Facebook. And to be honest, I only started using Twitter since the books came along. And I'm glad I did, because there's some great people on there. So Twitter will be the best place to follow me. And I think on Twitter, you'll have links to my books. And my website and other bits and bobs. So Twitter's a good place to start if you're interested in hearing me for details about horror films.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Adrian. That was great.
That's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris. Take care.
Cheers. Thank you.
Well, what a fantastic interview. Thank you so much to Adrian for joining me today. Please do check out his work, especially his latest book, Bled Dry, which is a fantastic read. I'm really pleased to announce as well that Adrian has donated a copy of Bled Dry to give away in a competition. To enter, just head over to my Twitter or Instagram, which are both @CW_STAGG, and check out the message labelled competition with a picture of the Bled Dry cover. The winner will be announced on my social media on Wednesday the 22nd of April. Thank you as always for you as well for joining me this week. I'll be back again soon, but there is time for one more of Adrian's picks. Here it is. Take care, and I'll see you next time.
This is my best disguise. My skin stepped out, my bones dry up for the rest of